Okay, all right. So yeah, I'm going to talk about gluons in hadrons and nuclei, and most of the talk will be about a very specific aspect of gluonic structure, but I thought I'd start just by giving a little bit of introduction. So over the last 60 years, we've learned a huge amount about quarks inside protons and neutrons and nuclei, and we now have a pretty detailed view of what the quark structure of the nucleon at least is. However, gluonic structure is, by contrast, relatively unexplored. And as you can see from the front cover of the EIC white paper, the electron-ion collider is basically a machine designed to change that. And it was obviously voted to be the highest priority in the 2015 Nuclear Physics Long Range Plan. And on the cover, you see the overarching goal of this facility is to understand the glue that binds us all. Okay. So this is a big task, and I should, since I've shown the Brookhaven version of the EIC, I should also show the JLab version of the EIC. This is a complicated task, and what I want to try and address today is one aspect of where lattice QCD can do something to help. Okay. So what do we know about gluons? Well, the unpolarized gluon PDF we know reasonably well. It's basically extracted from scaling violations and deep elastic scattering and various other experiments. As you can see here, this is a plot of the various Parton distributions, including the valence quarks, the C quarks, and the gluon Parton distribution. And the gluon one here is multiplied by 1 over 20. So as you go to small x, gluons dominate everything. This is really because of QCD evolution. So if you start off with quarks at high x as under evolution, they push towards small x and they radiate gluons, and then those gluons split into other gluons, and so you get a very large gluon density. Obviously, knowing this Parton distribution g of x is very important for the LHC because, for example, the primary production process for Higgs is through gluon-gluon fusion. Okay, so this is the polarized PDF of the nucleon. Also important is what happens when you go to a nucleus, and this is motivated by looking at this small x behavior. So if this thing keeps blowing up forever, that's going to cause a problem. And so what will happen, in fact, is that as you go to extremely large gluon densities at small Bjorkane x, as well as this splitting process, a recombination process becomes important, and the evolution equations change to incorporate that effect and get more complicated names. Rather than Dglap, they become the Jim-Walk equations. And if you sort of follow this idea to the extreme, as you go to extremely small x, you expect that something really quite novel happens, and you get a picture of a proton or a nucleus in which the gluon distribution actually knows nothing about the state that you're in, but it takes this sort of uniform nature, which is called a color glass condensate. So at the EIC, one of the main motivations to build this, making it an ion machine, is that you can learn about this physics, this very small x physics. And the way that we need ions is because this saturation scale at which this happens goes like it goes like 1 over A. So as you make A large, it becomes easier to reach that point. Okay. So that's why EIC is an ion collider. The other motivation for EIC is, as I said, to learn about gluons more generally. And so what we don't know about gluons is how they carry spin. So gluon helicity is something we know a little bit about. And learning this has been a major focus of the RIC spin program. So entire new systems were installed in RIC in order to be able to do this. And up here, you can see what's actually come out of this. And so along the bottom axis is what we know about the quark contribution to helicity, right? So it's actually pretty precisely constrained, 0.19 plus or minus about 0.03. But on the vertical axis, this is the gluon contribution to proton spin. And as you can see, the uncertainties are enormous. And so this is after the running of the RIC spin program to the current state. Okay. And this involves looking at a whole bunch of different processes that are fairly complicated to analyze, but basically based on polarized P collisions. So down the bottom is what we know about this quantity, but this you probably can't read this. This is the integral of this delta G structure function from x min to 1, where x min is this axis here. Okay, so at large x, we know something. As we go to small x, the light blue shaded region is what we currently know. And so the contribution blows up, and that's why we have this huge uncertainty on this contribution. So, yes? It is actually, yeah. Yes. I'll come to that in a second.
The upper plot that is only realistic.
Yes, it is. Yes. That's right. Yeah, so this, so for the gluon, the separation between helicity and orbital is very subtle and gauge dependent. The quark contribution, you can rigorously define the helicity piece and the orbital angular momentum piece. Yes, exactly. Delta sigma, this is. Okay, so this is, as you said, helicity. There's also orbital angular momentum, and this is even less understood from the gluonic point of view. And in order to really learn things about it, you need to start measuring transverse momentum-dependent Poulomb distributions and looking at correlations in space and momentum, a very complicated thing to do. And the EIC is essentially the machine that will be able to do that. Okay? So hopefully after EIC has run for some long period of time, we'll actually have a much cleaner picture of this. So part of what I'm going to talk about is really motivated by something that Abhay Deshpande talked about at the recent National Nuclear Physics Summer School, which happened to be at MIT. And it's a very natural question just to ask, well, what does a proton look like? And really what he was asking here is, how do the quarks and gluons compare to each other? Right? So we have sort of a range of phenomenological pictures of quarks inside the proton. Right? We have bag models, constituent quark models, and non-models. And these things, they give you different kind of descriptions of where you think the gluons are going to be, if you think about these models. So in the bag model, the bag is somehow coming from gluons, and so in this picture, he's distributed them over the whole thing. In constituent quark models, you get dressed quarks, which have lots of gluons near them. And in lattice gauge theory with static quarks, in this case here, it appears that the action density of the gluon field is stuck between them. But of course, this is not a proton, this is static quarks. So it's an omega B baryon, omega BBB baryon. And if you think about these pictures, well, in the first one, you might say that gluons are sort of distributed outside of quarks, near quarks, and inside quarks. Okay? And that's the sort of picture that is something that is very just kind of from a general public point of view, something that would be nice to be able to convey to people. But it's actually surprisingly difficult to even ask this question in a field theoretically well-defined way. It's also experimentally very difficult. So as we saw, we don't know that much about gluons. The EIC will hopefully change this. Also, the proton is a very quantum system, and of course, quarks and gluons mix under evolution, and what you mean by a quark or a gluon depends on what scale you look at it. So you might ask, well, how do we define something that we can really call quarky, right? And so we can do this by looking at non-singlet quantities. So we can look at flavor non-singlet or Q minus Q bar, for example. For gluons, it's actually not so obvious. But there is a quantity that is uniquely gluonic, or at least uniquely gluonic up to higher twist contributions. And this is called is a double helicity flip object. And because it's double helicity flip, it will only exist for targets, only will exist in the forward limit for targets that are of spin 1 or greater. And that's what I'm going to really talk about today. So before I do that, I just wanted to advertise a couple of other lattice QCD calculations. So the EIC is a long way off, and so hopefully we theorists can try and do something before that to learn about gluons. But it's a pretty challenging problem, and it's basically one of the worst signal-to-noise problems you could ask about in QCD, is to ask any question about gluons. And so for that reason, what people have done has been very, very sparse. So there are a couple of calculations or explorations of the gluon momentum fraction, and a couple of calculations, one of which is shown here, of the gluon contribution to spin. And up here, this is the rigorous separation of the spin of the proton into a quark helicity piece, quark orbital angular momentum piece, and gluon piece. And this here is the result of this lattice calculation by Kefei Liu and company, which actually addresses all of these different pieces. And you should certainly, this is sort of very schematic at the moment. There's a lot of lattice systematics that are not completely treated in this calculation and things like this, but this is kind of where we might end up going. Okay, so now I want to talk about a piece of work that I have done with my academic sister, Fiala, who's sitting here in the front row. And so this is a paper where we try and explore this double helicity flip Parton distribution. So I need to introduce this. And so this, the concept of this object was first introduced in this paper by Jaffe and Manohar with the very nice title of Nuclear Gluonometry, which is a mouthful. And it basically boils down to if you have a spin one or greater object, it's the gluonic equivalent of transversity. It just doesn't exist for spin half particles. It's also very interesting because if you think of a nucleus as a bunch of nucleons, then it's actually a probe of gluons that you can't uniquely associate with one of those nucleons. So it's really a test or an observable that is sensitive to the nucleus not just being individual nucleons. And this is something that we can rigorously define that, okay, the vacuum expectation value of some operator in a proton is zero, but in something made of a bunch of protons, it's non-zero. Okay? And that's why it's called exotic glue. So we have this picture from the EIC white paper of protons making a nucleus with all of the gluons stuck inside each of these protons, and Fiala has modified this to put gluons that go between the different ones, and these are the ones that this object is sensitive to. Okay. Right, so because of the symmetries that this operator has, you can't write down an analogous quark PDF at leading twist. So you have to write down operators that involve four quarks, and so they're suppressed by powers of Q squared relative to this gluonic object. So in the Bjorkane limit, this is gluonic, okay, and that's one of the nice things about it. As I said, it vanishes in the nucleon, so it really probes nuclear effects in the nucleus directly, and it's experimentally accessible. And so last year, there was a letter of intent put into JLab that is attempting to use an ammonia target. So in ammonia, the nitrogen is in spin one, and so it has this. And so the idea is to use that target and attempt to measure this delta of X structure function of nitrogen. And this is the PI of this experiment is going to be James Maxwell, which is fun. So you can also try and get at this at the EIC if you polarize nuclei as well, which is experimentally challenging, but if you can do it, there's a whole lot of things that are quite interesting. And so Richard Milner, also at MIT, has been really thinking very hard about what you can do and whether this is feasible. And I think it's not crazy that this is something we'll get into the design for EIC at some point. From my point of view, the most important thing about this is that you can calculate something about it in Lattice QCD, and that's what we've done. So to get to that, I need to tell you just a little bit about the structure of this thing. So when you do deep inelastic scattering on a spin one target, the hadronic tensor gets much more complicated than in a spin half target. So you have a bunch of additional unpolarized structure functions. So there's B1, B2, B3, B4. These STs and Us are just tensors involving the polarizations of the initial and final state, so E and E prime, and the momenta. And the problem, you get the usual polarized structure functions, and then you get this additional piece here, which involves this double helicity flip. Okay, and this was first realized by Jaffe and Manohar. So what is this guy? Well, again, it's some horrible tensor written out in terms of the polarization vectors of this system. Now it gets pretty complicated. And then there's a structure function delta, which depends on Bjorkheim X and the scale Q squared. It's called double helicity flip because when you start with the this W mu nu and write it out in terms of helicity amplitude basis, so these objects here are a fixed initial and final photon helicity and target helicity here. This piece here corresponds to the plus minus goes to minus plus piece here. So schematic in this diagram here, you can, oh, you can't actually, because you can't see that there's a sign flip here. That's weird. So you come in with a photon with helicity plus one, and a target with helicity minus one, an outgoing photon has minus one, and target has plus one. Okay. And the leading piece that contributes to this is really this quark loop here. Right? And if you wanted to do something that could do this with just quarks, you would need to basically pull two legs out of here for the two quarks. And so that would be a twist four contribution. Okay, so this is measurable in unpolarized scattering on a transversely polarized target. So that's shown here. So this is the electron beam. If you polarize the target in the plane defined by K and S, that's the target, and then measure an outgoing electron that's azimuthally separated by an angle phi, you can get at delta from looking at the phi dependence here. Okay. It also has a Parton model interpretation, in that it's going to be the difference between g of x hat and g of y hat, where g is the probability that you find a gluon with momentum fraction x linearly polarized in the two directions perpendicular to the beam. Okay, so it's the difference between those two things. Okay, so it also, of course, you can take x moments of this distribution, and as with lattice calculations relevant for other Parton distributions, that means you can get at those moments through local operator matrix elements. So this first line might look a little strange because of the fact of alpha sitting out the front there, but that's really because the leading piece comes from from this closed quark loop guy here. Okay, so there's additionally already a factor of alpha suppression of this distribution. Okay. So if you think about the going through the operator product expansion of W mu, writing it in terms of T mu nu, and then doing the usual OPE, the operators that actually correspond to the numbers AN that you measure here, or that you can get from this distribution, correspond to matrix elements of this operator here, right, which is constructed from two gluon field strength tensors and a bunch of covariant derivatives. And it is the S operator here is symmetrizing this in all of the mu 1 through mu n indices, but not the mu and nu index here. So this is slightly different than if you look at the symmetries of the unpolarized operators here, where you would be symmetrizing over all of these indices and then contracting nu and mu. Okay. And because of this different symmetry property, it can have a dependence on the polarization vectors here that's like this. Okay. this is a local operator, and so you can do lattice calculations of it, and so you can determine these numbers here. And that's what we will do. However, you have to worry a little bit, because this is an object that has Lorentz spin n, and we're going to do a lattice calculation where we go from Minkowski space to a discrete space. And so the symmetries that we have are reduced from when we go first to Euclidean space and then to the lattice. We're going from O4 down to the hypercubic subgroup. And there's now just a set of finite rotations we're allowed to do. There are in fact 20 different irreducible representations of this group, and this is just showing what their dimensionalities are here. And when you think about these operators with lots of indices, you have to ask, well, how do these operators transform under the residual symmetries that we're left with? Okay, so we can look at a sort of a simple operator, which is this psi bar gamma mu d nu psi, where I've symmetrized the mu and nu and trace subtracted this. So to get the transformation of this under the Lorentz group, I take two spin one objects, so the gamma and the d, and then I take tensor products of those, and I'm after the traceless symmetric piece, so I'm looking for this red representation at the end. Okay, so now when I take my space-time and go to a discrete lattice, I have to ask, well, where do the components of this thing live? And what representations do they live? So luckily for us, the hypercubic group has a four-dimensional representation that is the analog of the vector representation in the Lorentz group. So I just take two of those, so these four objects, and take the tensor product of those and do the decomposition. And the nine components of this traceless symmetric representation break into two pieces. They break into a triplet and a sextet, right, under the hypercubic group. So you can look at examples of things that live in those. In the sextet, we have something like this. So it's symmetric and traceless, as you can see. And then there are various rotations of that object. And then something that lives in the triplet is this one here. So these operators, because they came from the same continuum operator, have to have the same continuum limit, but at finite lattice spacing, they don't have to be the same. Okay. A nice thing about this operator is that it only will depend on the time components, and so I can actually measure a matrix element of this in a proton at rest. And so that's nice for a lattice calculation, because as you introduce momenta, the noise in calculations goes up. So this one here, because it involves the one component, I need a non-zero P1 in order to measure that, and that will make that calculation harder. So another thing that's nice about this operator is that these two representations, I can't construct any operator of lower dimension that lives in those representations. Yep. These guys? So I measure it in a state with P equals zero. They give no contribution, and I just measure this one. Right? Okay. In this three and six representation, these are the lowest dimensional operators that you can write down that live in those representations. So if you have operators of lower dimension that exist in the same representation in H4, under a renormalization, they will mix into these operators. And so if you have lower dimensional operators, life will be very bad. So another example is an operator with an additional derivative, and this has this bad feature. So here we do the same tensor decomposition now of three vectors, and now we're after this 16-dimensional representation, three halves, which is the traceless symmetric three-index object. Doing the hypercubic decomposition, that mixes into three different representations. Okay. One of them, something that has indices that look like this, actually mixes with this operator, which is two dimensions lower. Okay, and that's really bad, because if I try and calculate this three-index object here, I will have to worry about mixing that goes with a coefficient of 1 over the lattice spacing with this operator. And as I take the continuum limit, life becomes very bad. And unfortunately, if I go beyond this three-index object with quark fields, this always happens. There's no way you can avoid this operator mixing, because basically you've run out of representations of the hypercubic group. There's only a finite number, and you're stuck. And so we have to think much harder about how to measure higher moments of partial distributions. So this gluonic operator is a little bit different. So it lives in a representation that is not entirely symmetric and traceless. Okay, so it's symmetric and traceless in the mu with subscript indices. And so here we're just going to talk about the n equals 2 operator, where we just have g mu, mu 1, g nu, mu 2, symmetrized in mu 1 and mu 2. And because the indices are on field strength tensors, the other pairs of indices are anti-symmetric. Okay, so the young frame corresponding to that symmetry group is shown up at the top there. So when you take this object and subduce it into the hypercubic group, it becomes somewhat more complicated, and it gets contributions from a whole lot of different representations. Although I should have just brought that up straight away. So the ones that are traceless and symmetric are now these three representations shown in green. And these ones here are all representations that don't have operators of lower dimension that mix with them. So this is nice. So there's three different representations we can use. We can, in principle, measure every component of this object. So now we need to construct it, and so we use the Clover definition of the field strength tensor in order to do that. So G mu nu is written in terms of these complicated sets of paths around the point here in terms of the link variables. And then we just combine that into G mu nu and then apply the appropriate symmetries and construct this operator. Okay. Now, for this talk, I'm only going to talk about the bare lattice operator. And so there is a perturbative renormalization that in principle we should do to get from our lattice operator to, to the continuum operator. But that perturbative renormalization is going to go like 1 plus order g squared. And for similar operators, you find numbers like 0.9 or 1.1. Okay, so this strictly the number that we're going to talk about is not the final number, but this renormalization has some complications that we've not quite dealt with yet. Okay, so this is now the lattice details. So we're going to take this operator, we're going to try and measure it in a spin 1 hadron. So what we've done now is measure it in a phi meson, which is sort of the simplest spin 1 object you can look at. But eventually we're going to try and do this in nuclei. And so we hope that by the end of this program, with Mike sitting back there, we will get this underway. I was thinking he wasn't here, but he is. Okay, so this is a pretty simple lattice calculation. It's really just an exploration that we can actually do this calculation. It uses just one lattice spacing, one lattice volume, one set of quark masses, with light quarks corresponding to a relatively heavy pi mass of 450. And strange quarks that are basically at the physical value, so you get a phi meson mass that's pretty close to experiment. Okay. And as I said, most of the systematics are not addressed, so we haven't taken the continuum limit, we haven't gone to an infinite volume, and we're at a fixed mass. The difficulty here is that you need extreme statistics to be able to measure these gluonic observables, and so while measuring the quark momentum fraction, you could do with the order of a few thousand measurements. Here, we've done 100,000 measurements, and we would like to do more, but that's all we could afford. So how do we do this? Well, it's very much like you've heard other people talk about earlier in the week. We take ratios of correlators. So we define some three-point correlator. There are actually another line connecting these other quarks in our phi meson here, which you can't see. And then on the top diagram, we have a source at time 0, a sink at time t, and then somewhere in the middle, we insert this gluonic object. Okay. And unlike in the case of measuring quark observables, There is no connection via quark lines between this gluon object and the source and sink, obviously. Okay. So we take the ratio of that thing to a two-point function, which is just the phi meson to phi meson here, and that is essentially proportional to the non-perturbative number A2, that's the moment of this pattern distribution, D. So if you ask about global spectroscopy, there is. So for three-point functions, not really.
But you would expect it to blow up if
No. No. It should not get that much worse. So if we keep with just a phi meson, right? So we're keeping this. So the two-point correlator, if we try and make the strange quarks lighter and lighter and lighter, that will get noisier. But the thing here is that it's actually the correlation between that two-point object and this gluonic operator. And so there's sort of two competing sources of noise here. And the gluonic piece, that doesn't change with mass.
So if you make the quarks very heavy,
would the calculation not be any easier? Yeah, it is, because one of the components of noise has gone away. So you're just trying to beat the gluonic noise now. So just more specifically, so these are our interpolators. So because we're using a phi meson, we have polarizations at the source and the sink. And in order to get what we want, we have to take ratios of these three-point functions with polarizations to two-point functions with polarizations. And I've got an example of what that matrix R is going to look like. So if I take momentum zero, that matrix is diagonal in the polarization indices, and you can see that each component has this number A2 on it, and so I can basically average over these in some way to get a measurement of A2. If I go to a non-zero momentum, so some number times 111, it gets much more complicated, but in fact everything here is proportional to A2. So if you can, if you could read these, you could work out what combination I would form to get a nice measurement of A2. And that's what we had to do. And the results are shown here. So because we've got a source sink separation time t and an operator insertion time tau, there's sort of two dimensions we need to look at in order to see the signal. So the top plot shows the source sink separation dependence, and the bottom plots for fixed sink time, 11 and 9, show for those fixed sinks where we put the operator in the middle. And so, as you can see, if we fix the sink time to 9, so we have a source here, a sink there, and then move the operator around, there's a region in which there's a flat behavior. And so what you expect is that there's exponential contamination by excited states if your source and sink are too close together, or your source and operator are too close together, or your operator and sink are too close together. But in this middle region, you find this flat behavior. And so we can study that as a function of all of these variables quite cleanly. And so here, this is a set of plots showing the measurement as a function of the operator time for increasing sink time. So we're pulling this source and sink further and further apart, and then moving the operator around all in between it. And in each case, you see this plateau at non-zero value, and this line corresponds to the value that we extract. So over on the right, we see a two-dimensional plot of this. So we have the operator insertion time and the sink time going up here. And so if you look back at the top plot here, you see as we pull the sink further apart, noise grows. And so as we go up this plot here, the data become less and less useful because they have large fluctuations. And then you need to be And the operator you want to be not near the source and not near the sink, so there's sort of a triangular region in which the best signal with the least contamination and least noise exists, and that's how we get the number out. We do some average over that.
Yeah. So do you do this calculation using the external field method as well?
It's sort of different because the construction of the gluon operator you do everywhere all at once. Yeah, it's different. Okay, so now I can just show you the results. So this is the many different results we have. So there are three different representations. So there's over here one representation, another representation, and a third representation. And for each of those representations, there are different vectors that live in that representation. And then we can also use a two-point correlator where we have a boost on it. So we can have a momentum squared 2 rho meson correlator that we're doing. And as you can see, all of these things come out pretty much consistent. Between these three regions, you don't actually expect, these don't have to agree because these have lattice artifacts between them. But they do, and so this is telling you that the lattice artifacts are pretty small, which is not crazy. And it also tells you that at least some aspects of the renormalization that we've ignored are also not going to be wildly varying. Okay, so that's just that number, and as I said, that number, you can multiply that by 0.8 or 1.2 because there's a missing renormalization factor, so you shouldn't take too much into that number at the moment. One thing we can do with this number is ask a sort of interesting question that's based on a bound that was constructed for quark parton distributions called the Sofer bound, and this is a relation between the quark transversity, the unpolarized quark PDF, and the helicity PDF, and this is a bound that the modulus of the transversity is less than half the sum of the polarized and unpolarized. Okay. You can take this thing and you can take moments of it, and you can, for example, take the second moment and you find that the second moment of transversity has to be bounded by the moments of momentum and helicity. And then you can actually say, well, what are these numbers? And Marcus Diehl and collaborators in 2005 calculated these matrix elements at a heavy value of the quark mass, not that different from what we're using, and they find that this bound is saturated at about the 80% level for quarks. So there's a gluonic analog of this, where instead of the transversity, unpolarized and polarized quark distributions, you have matrix elements of the unpolarized operator, the analog of the delta Q, so the something involving G and the field and the G twiddle, and then the operator that I've just been talking about. Oh, sorry, this is the one I've just been talking about, and this is the unpolarized one where we can track these indices. Okay. So in order to ask whether this is satisfied, we have to actually also measure this guy. But if we can measure the 4-index one, we can measure the 2-index one, and we do. This is, again, just these plots of different representations and different boosts. And as you can see, there's also pretty good consistency, so there's not really going to be crazy lattice artifacts here. And so then we can take these numbers and ask what this Sofer bound does. And so on the side of the gluon transversity, we have 0.2, and over here we have 0.3. So again, this is satisfied at basically order half to one. Yep, exactly. So it's interesting because when you go beyond the parton model and start thinking about running of PDFs, it actually, I believe it also holds, which is a little surprise. It tells you, I think that's right. Yeah. I think, I'm not sure you can prove it has to be stable, but it apparently is numerically. Yeah, okay. No. No. It's sort of a, no, it's not. It's not that kind of, it's not like a Weingarten type bound, no. So all of this is for this phi meson, okay? And I tried to motivate being interested in this because, well, you might want to try and measure this in nitrogen, which is not a phi meson. So the next step that we're going to try and do is actually do a calculation of this in a deuteron, which is a feasible calculation at heavy quark masses now. Hopefully that will get going very soon. But we can also do more general things. So we can, as well as measuring forward matrix elements, we can ask more detailed questions. So we can ask questions about what happens when you take an initial state with momentum p and a final state with momentum p prime, and take the matrix elements of the same operator in those states. And so this corresponds to measuring not Poulin distributions or moments of Poulin distributions, but measuring moments of generalized Poulin distributions. And these get more complicated, so instead of one unknown number, we now have a whole bunch of different form factors that are a function of p minus p prime here. But having form factors means that we can actually define radii. So we're going back to this idea of asking what is the gluonic radii versus the quark radii of a proton. Well, here, at least for a phi meson, you could ask this question. And in fact, for a proton, you can also ask this question, because even in a spin half target, this object has non-vanishing matrix elements if you look at off-forward matrix elements. So if we can measure, say, A21G, as a function of the momentum transfer, we can actually define a radius and compare that to some analogous quark radius of this object. Okay? And so that's what we've been doing recently. And is there a question? No? Okay. And this is labeled schematic because we've found some not correct things in the analysis that we were doing of this, and so this will be updated. But basically, we're able to measure with reasonable statistical precision form factors of this operator in this phi meson. And eventually, then we can take those and compare them with radii extracted from, for example, the electromagnetic form factors of the same object, and answer this question of where the quarks are distributed relative to the gluons. Okay, so I think that's really all I have to say, so I won't hold you up from coffee. But I think in the near-term future, with the EIC almost certainly going ahead, we're going to learn a lot about gluonic structure of nucleons and of nuclei. And eventually we will get to the state where we really have quite a precise three-dimensional picture of the partonic structure of those objects, both from the quark point of view and also the gluonic point of view. And this delta G object is, I think, has a pretty interesting role, because it really is something, almost the only thing that is purely gluonic at leading twist. And it also has this nice aspect that it really asks questions that are non-nucleonic about a nucleus. So I think also, by doing lattice calculations, we can really ask these questions about where quarks live versus where gluons live, and hopefully say something that will help motivate various aspects of the EIC. So, for example, whether light nuclei will get polarized at the EIC. Thank you. The whole EIC?
What's needed to really...
Okay, so that's above my pay grade, but it's really... So the next step in the EIC is actually getting a National Academy endorsement of it. And basically that's going to happen in the next 12 months, is the plan. Well, whether it actually happens, of course, we don't know, but... and then beyond that, once that happens, then I think DOE is going to start spending money. And the stated time frame is 2025. So, we'll see.
Is there an academy committee then that's been appointed to study this?
Or? Yes, they're very, very right now is when they are being appointed, and they know some names, I think, but not the entire composition. Yep.
But the time scale is 1 year.
For that review, yep.
Report.
Yep.
Endorsement.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. Dean.
So this concept of the gluonic radius is kind of interesting. I'm just curious, so comparing with the photon is penetrating the nucleus, I understand that the gluon, does it actually penetrate the surface, or would you just be measuring, right? Because it has so many interactions with so many strongly interacting things. Do you actually get deep into the
Well, I mean, what you measure is really a form factor, right? And you might ask, well, here we had 5 different form factors. I could measure a radius from every one of those, right? And which one you want to talk about is sort of up to you. But, I mean, if you measure large Q behavior here, that's corresponding to short distances inside the target, right? Yeah, I mean, and also these are weird gluons, right? It's this difference between gluons that are polarized one way versus the other way relative to the target. So, yeah. I mean, I think probably the right thing to compare is this radius to a radius coming from a transversity quark generalized Poisson distribution. Yep. So it's kind of interesting because basically the way you should think about this diagram is that the renormalization scale, factorization scale is here. So this is all perturbative. And so you could calculate, so basically it goes into Wilson coefficients. So those Wilson coefficients do depend on the masses, but not the lattice calculation masses, luckily. Yeah. I'm not sure I can actually think of an application of it at EIC. You can measure it. But you mean, is it something you need for input for some other experiment?
Yeah, the obvious example would be PDF simulations.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's really... I mean, so just think about the gluon helicity. So the only reason you'd need to know that if you had polarized P collisions, which is why you can measure it in that case. But yeah, it's not really a tool for doing other physics, I don't think.
Yeah,